Chinese utilities are telling homes and factories across the country to turn off the power with little warning.
The suddenness of it definitely caught a lot of people off guard. They just cut the power off. There's no fines or anything like that, but they just immediately walk in, shut your power off.
Also on the show, a second day of hearings on Capitol Hill about what went wrong with the pullout from Afghanistan. But did we get answers?
Not really enough. It was unfortunate to hear so much time trying to position the sort of virtue of the current president or his predecessor.
And in Cuba, one imprisoned artist is sent into exile, while another artist wonders if she'll ever be allowed to return home.
This is the magic of Cuba. The government can do whatever they want.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World on a Wednesday. Thanks for being with us. Large parts of China have gone dark. Across the country, unprecedented power outages are impacting homes and factories, in some cases with devastating results. At a factory in northern Liaoning province, ventilators shut down without warning. 23 people were then rushed to the hospital with carbon monoxide poisoning. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai joins me now. Rebecca, how far-reaching and widespread are these power outages?
Well, the outages are impacting people differently around the country. People in northeastern Liaoning province were complaining online about shopping centers shutting down because of lack of power, and there was concern that the water supply might be affected as well. I talked with somebody in northern Jilin province who told me the street lights and traffic lights in their neighborhood were affected. In southern Guangdong province, a university student told me that the lights and air conditioning cut out in the middle of her class. And I spoke with Chris May, who's an American working for a plastics manufacturing company. He told me that on Sunday, the industrial park where his factory is located sent out a message over WeChat that power would be shut off immediately.
The suddenness of it definitely caught a lot of people off guard. They just cut the power off. I've heard stories about, like, you know, they have people going around checking, and if you're using power, then, you know, they don't, there's no fines or anything like that, but they just immediately, like, they'll just walk in, shut your power off, and then just leave after that.
Wow, with no warning.
Yeah, so he told me his company sent their factory workers home for an early vacation ahead of a week-long holiday, but they have no way of knowing when they're going to be able to start up production again, and that makes it very hard to know how to plan ahead.
So why are these outages happening, Rebecca?
Well, there's a number of factors. First of all, you have to understand China is still very reliant on coal. It does import some, but the vast majority of its coal is domestically produced. And right now, the country is going through a coal shortage. I spoke with Adam Ni, who's a co-author of a China Current Affairs newsletter. He said there's a lot of reasons for power disruptions. One, the government has kept the price of energy down for residential and industrial users, despite the coal shortage. So power plants are operating at a loss. And another factor is that China is trying to be more energy efficient.
China is trying to be more efficient in terms of energy usage. It has certain goals about carbon neutrality, about energy sufficiency. So that has led to, you know, certain targets for local governments.
So China is trying to meet these emission targets. In August, it ordered 20 cities and provinces to reduce their energy consumption for the rest of the year. Now, at the same time, Ni says there's rising consumer demand around the world for Chinese-made goods. So that's also putting pressure on the energy grid here. So these are just some of the many factors that are playing into the coal shortage and the power outages.
I gather the government in Beijing came out with an official response today to the power outages. What did they say?
So today the government issued a statement about the power supply. It said it will ramp up coal and natural gas production, but it will also limit coal usage in the most energy-hungry sectors like steel and cement. And it also promised that it would avoid limiting residential power use. And I spoke with Li Shuo, who is global policy analyst at Greenpeace East Asia, and he said more changes need to be made.
So I think the key lesson here is the Chinese energy and power system really needs to find better ways to stay resilient, to be able to react to the numerous new challenges that are ahead of us. If the lesson that people draw from this episode is we should actually open up more new coal mines and build more coal-fired power plants, I'm afraid we will not be able to meet the new climate ambition, and that's certainly a false lesson.
Winter is fast approaching, Rebecca. How long are these power outages expected to last?
Well, that's the question everyone is asking. The experts I spoke to all said this problem is not going to go away in a few days or even a few weeks. These power shortages could last months, they said.
The World's China correspondent, Rebecca Canther, in Shanghai. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thanks, Marco.
Later this hour, China's massive project to build industrial projects around the globe is incurring huge debts for host countries. Ahead, we hear the findings of a new report detailing the extent of that. A logistical success, but a strategic failure. That's how top U.S. generals described the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in a second day of hearings today on Capitol Hill, this time before the House Armed Services Committee. Author Sarah Chase was watching. She served as a special advisor to the U.S. military in Afghanistan and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff after a decade on the ground in Kandahar. Sarah, a lot of the most intense questioning today dealt with intelligence failures, questions about how do we miss the rapid collapse of the Afghan government. Here's how Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin tried to answer that in his opening statement.
We need to consider some uncomfortable truths that we did not fully comprehend the depth of corruption and poor leadership in their senior ranks, that we did not grasp the damaging effect of frequent and unexplained rotations by President Ghani of his commanders, that we did not anticipate the snowball effect caused by the deals that the Taliban commanders struck with local leaders in the wake of the Doha agreement.
Sarah, what do you make of that explanation for the lack of military intelligence?
It's just stunning to me, but in a way not surprising. So much U.S. intelligence was focused on who we should kill instead of being focused on the degree of corruption, not just in the ranks of the Afghan military, but throughout the government and the effect that that would have on the willingness of Afghan citizens to take mortal risks for their own government. You know, I mean, that information was being hammered on successive U.S. administrations for years. I was one of the hammerers and not at all alone. And so I find that very distressing. And then the snowball effect of the local deals. I think this is another really significant failing on the intelligence and military side is misunderstanding how Afghans wage war. Afghans rarely fight as units to the death. Fighting is much more a kind of psychological exercise. That's why it's often quite violent. So you have the combination of the Taliban who were making battlefield victories, a Doha agreement that essentially conferred sovereignty on them, and then they went to work on the ground, as he said. How could the United States government have missed that context?
Joint Chiefs Chair General Mark Milley tried to provide an answer for how the U.S. failed to predict the Afghan government's collapse.
Well, we can count the trucks and the guns and the units and all that. We can watch that from different techniques, but we can't measure a human heart from a machine. You got to be there to do that. And I think that was probably one of the most significant contributing factors to missing the deterioration in the morale of the Afghan army.
Sarah Chase, what do you make of General Milley's comments there?
We were there for 20 years. We were on the ground for 20 years, and we still missed that type of psychological and social intelligence. We never got close enough to ordinary people.
Well, you spoke earlier of the lack of understanding of how Afghans wage war. I mean, General Milley at one point questioned why the U.S. had tried to build an Afghan army in our own image. What was he getting at?
He put his finger on what you really can hang around the military's neck, is why would you create in an environment of very difficult terrain where wars are constantly being won by ill-armed, ill-equipped insurgents, why would you create a conventional army that looks like ours, that requires highly technical equipment that people need to maintain, that seems to require air support, although the Taliban never seemed to need air support. And that, again, was going on for 20 years. And I think we really have to ask ourselves as a country, why? What was the incentive structure behind building that type of a top-heavy, equipment-heavy military? And were economic interests not involved here? I mean, is this not the type of equipment and contractor support that is delivered by very high-end military contractors whose executives have been building fancy mansions around Washington, D.C. for the last decade?
So the starting point for the hearings this week seemed to be that the problems with the U.S. project in Afghanistan were fundamentally military, and that's why generals were brought before lawmakers today and called to task. But weren't a lot of the fundamental problems also civilian?
Well, exactly. Thank you, Marco. And I hope that civilian officials will be called soon. And first and foremost, for me, it would be Zal Khalilzad, who is responsible for the actual terms of the Doha Agreement, which I think
Zalmay Khalilzad, the special envoy for Afghanistan.
That's exactly right. He's an Afghan-American who conducted these negotiations at President Trump's behest in Doha. Those negotiations, as far as I know, were conducted in Pashto without any member of the U.S. government who spoke the language present other than the ambassador. And they essentially conferred sovereignty on the Taliban. How would we expect an Afghan government not to be demoralized under those conditions?
Author Sarah Chase served as a special advisor to the U.S. military from 2008 to 2012. Her most recent book is On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. Sarah, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco. It's great to be with you.
Hundreds of thousands of younger immigrants continue to live in limbo here in the U.S., the so-called Dreamers, people who were given legal protections from deportation and a work permit under DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. In July, a federal judge in Texas ruled that the Obama-era program was not legal. This week, the Biden administration took steps to keep the protections in place. The World's Daisy Contreras has more.
Now, let's be clear. This is not amnesty. This is not immunity.
That's President Barack Obama in the White House Rose Garden in 2012 when he announced DACA. He did so without the approval of Congress. It was an executive order which can be overturned.
This is a temporary stopgap measure that lets us focus our resources wisely while giving a degree of relief and hope to talented, driven, patriotic young people.
It's been nearly a decade since then, and many have fought the program in courts, including President Donald Trump. Over the summer, a federal judge ruled the program was illegal because Obama had skipped some rulemaking steps, that is, to make the DACA executive order open to public comment before it became an official federal regulation. So this week, the Biden administration began the process to comply with the judge's ruling and send the DACA proposal to what's called the Federal Register. That's sort of like the federal government's newspaper. It's where all proposed rules are published for the public to see and comment on. Unless the rule gets substantial negative comments, it becomes official policy.
It's a well-crafted, well-thought-out proposed rule.
That's Stephen Yell Lair, an immigration law professor at Cornell Law School.
This rule will help strengthen and fortify the DACA program until Congress can enact a permanent solution. So it's another way to bulletproof the program from litigation.
But Karen Tumlin says she thinks this process for DACA is unnecessary. She's an immigration attorney with Justice Action Center, a nonprofit out of California.
Not everything that is done by the federal government has to go through this very cumbersome, very time-intensive process. If it did, the wheels of this government would grind to a halt.
Tumlin says the process could also have unintended consequences. The final DACA rule could be much different from the current program. One possible change is the elimination of work permits, which the administration suggested as an option. That worries people like Juliana Macedo do Nascimento. She's with United We Dream, a youth-led immigration organization. Do Nascimento is also a DACA recipient. These possible changes show the urgency to pass immigration reform, she says.
We feel like we're in this roller coaster, right? Going from court case to court case, and we just don't have the stability in our lives.
The public now has 60 days to comment. Those comments will then go to the Department of Homeland Security for review, which could take at least 6 months to complete. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
Coming up, an apology from the WHO hints at bigger problems in humanitarian aid. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. As if the World Health Organization isn't taking enough heat these days, now the WHO is under the microscope for how it handled an Ebola outbreak 3 years ago. An independent investigation found dozens of instances of sexual abuse involving WHO employees in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Today, the WHO's regional director for Africa, Dr. Shidi Moeti, apologized. She said the organization was horrified and heartbroken by the findings. Joining us now to discuss this is Amy Costello. She's a host of the Tiny Spark podcast. How common is this kind of sexual abuse in the aid and development sector, Amy, especially during outbreaks?
Unfortunately, Marco, it's incredibly common because you kind of have a perfect storm in these situations. Whether it's an emergency crisis or an ongoing crisis, you have men and women coming in with lots of money relative to the places where they're working. You have local populations who are in desperate need of one thing or another, often basic human commodities that they need. And so there is an opportunity here for exploitation, for people from the outside or even locals who are being paid by organizations like the World Health Organization to kind of wield their power for their own benefit, in this case, sexual benefit.
It's probably hard for many people to even conceive that this kind of abuse at the hands of people whose job it is ostensibly to help is happening. What is your reaction to the WHO's apology for the sexual abuse in the DRC?
I think apologies are always important. I think what matters is what follows. Often we hear a lot of lip service paid in light of allegations like this, but very little done monetarily. And so the organization will really speak to its commitment in addressing this issue when we see what kind of money and staffing they're actually going to put to this problem.
You said, sadly, this happens a lot. What has been done by other organizations to try and stop this kind of sexual abuse?
Things that organizations have done are to set up things like hotlines, allow anonymous reporting, to have training for staff. And I think what we don't know is all about the underreporting of these issues. So we can have data that comes out that talks about the number of cases of harassment and abuse within any organization. But as happens with sexual abuse all over the world, it tends to be underreported, all the more so in these kinds of situations where there is very little incentive for recipients of aid to come forward with allegations because they so desperately need the aid that's coming to them.
So we've been talking about the WHO. You said earlier, Amy, this is not uncommon. How widespread are these dynamics?
You know, we've seen with many organizations, whether it's Oxfam, whether it's Doctors Without Borders, Save the Children, so many major aid organizations have had to confront this issue. And again, I just think if you step back and think about the dynamics in any kind of crisis situation when you have very powerful people with lots of resources interacting very closely with a vulnerable population, this kind of sexual exploitation and abuse is bound to occur.
Amy, what do you think the WHO should do to build back faith in their mission in the DRC now?
Well, they need to anticipate another crisis like this, which can happen overnight. And with that in mind, I think it's really important to try to get training to everyone who may or may not find themselves going to crisis zones like this. Again, it's really going to be in the next weeks and months to see if anybody at the organization is fired. So it will be interesting to see if there are any staff changes and what kind of, you know, power they put into any new positions or any initiatives that might be brought forward to address what is really a very serious problem.
Yeah, thanks for making that point. Amy Costello, the host of the Tiny Spark podcast. She's also the senior correspondent and investigations editor for the nonprofit quarterly news site. Amy, it is good to have you with us to discuss this. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
China has become well known for building up infrastructure projects in low and middle income countries across the globe, their so-called Belt and Road Initiative. What's not so well known? They're making things run on a lot of borrowed money. To make China's Belt and Road Initiative go, China loans out huge sums of money to build dams, railroads, and highways. When countries default, sometimes they have to give up bits of sovereignty to China, like control of a seaport, for example. Some experts call it a debt trap. A new study from William and Mary College looked into all of this. Brad Parks directs research for the Aid Data Study. So what example really stuck out to you, Brad, in terms of countries with a massive underreported debt to Belt and Road?
The volume of hidden debt in particular is staggering. We find not only $385 billion of hidden debt, but we find that the problem's getting worse, not better over time. An example of this would be Venezuela. So Venezuela contracted about $90 billion of debt to state lenders in China, and they have publicly disclosed only $699 million of that $90
billion. Wow.
So that $90 billion, just to put that in perspective, it represents 20% of the country's GDP.
So how and why does this underreporting happen? And did it start with the introduction of Belt and Road back in 2013?
It predated the Belt and Road Initiative, but Belt and Road has kind of supercharged the problem. So the authorities in China faced a real challenge getting off the ground, and that was many government couldn't take on any more debt. And so China had to get creative. And so its state lenders decided, let's start issuing loans to entities other than the central government, like state-owned companies, state-owned banks. And those debts, for the most part, they never show up on government balance sheets. So this has really blurred the distinction between private debt and public debt. And if you're in a finance ministry, this challenge of managing hidden Chinese debt, it's less about knowing that you will need to service undisclosed debts. It's more about not knowing. I call it a sort of phantom menace.
Interesting. So how did your team uncover all this underreported debt? And given how wide-reaching Belt and Road is, I'm guessing you need a large team to scrape all this data.
Yeah, we assembled a team of 130 research assistants and professional staff. And despite the fact that China shrouds its overseas lending portfolio in secrecy, one of the things we do is we go to the borrowers.
What happens when China eventually wants these loans back? Will those countries be facing like just a huge bill? And what happens if they can't pay it?
One thing that's kind of unique about these official sector loans from China is that, you know, the conventional wisdom is that China is collateralizing these loans on illiquid assets like a port or an electricity grid. And actually what we find is they're savvier than that. What they're doing is they're collateralizing on, we call them grab-and-go assets that you can put in your backpack and walk out the front door with. Mm. So an example of this is they'll ask a borrower to maintain a minimum cash balance in an offshore bank account. So in the event that you can't repay your debts, they have an asset that they can seize without having to go to a judge.
Bottom line, it sounds like China will be making sure it's still in control of the debt.
They want to be repaid on time and with interest.
Brad, finally, the Biden administration's Build Back Better spending bill has a lot of money earmarked for international infrastructure. Could that be competition for Belt and Road?
Absolutely. The White House has officials in Latin America today on a listening tour to talk to some of the disaffected participants in the Belt and Road Initiative. And Beijing is really running into a buyer's remorse issue. Many foreign leaders who were initially eager to jump on the Belt and Road bandwagon, they're now suspending or canceling Chinese infrastructure projects because of these debt sustainability concerns, and also because changes in public opinion in their own countries are making it difficult for these leaders to maintain close relationships with Beijing.
Brad Parks is the director of William & Mary College's Aid Data Study on China's Belt and Road Initiative. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Birdwatchers the world over are discovering the mountains of Colombia as farmers are making birding a little easier on them.
Before this place exists, you have to walk, hiking 2 days, and camping there trying to see them.
A win for birders, farmers, and forest preservation. That and the problem with your favorite avocado ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The cross-border bridge between Del Rio, Texas, and Ciudad Acuña, Mexico, has been reopened. The big encampment under the bridge is also empty. Just days ago, some 16,000 migrants, most of them originally from Haiti, were taking refuge there. Many of those people were deported on flights back to Haiti. Some were allowed to apply for asylum in the U.S. We wanted to know more about how and why this large group of people ended up on the Texas border. So we sent the world's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, to one of the heavily worn points along their journey. He's near Mexico's border with Guatemala. Jorge, tell us where you are exactly and what you're seeing.
Hey, Marco. I am in the southernmost city of Mexico. It is called Tapachula, small city, about 300,000 population. And it is about 300,000 population, about a half hour from the closest border crossing with Guatemala. And more specifically, where I am standing right now is a street that has become known as the Haitian Market. We're right next door to the biggest market in the city, and right now I'm looking at somebody give a haircut on the corner. I'm looking at people hawking rice and green beans, fried turnovers. So a lot of people from Haiti both selling and buying. And if you hear a lot of noise behind me, Marco, it's because it is a bustling marketplace. And I was here just 2 years ago, and I can tell you this was definitely not here that long ago.
And why do you believe the people who arrived in Del Rio, Texas, came from this little Haiti in Tapachula where you are right now?
Well, we can't say with full certainty, but this is something that I have been asking every single person who I've spoken to this week. And Tapachula, just for some context really quick, Tapachula is a city that has been a crossroads for people in migration for a very long time. Since pre-colonial Spanish times, this was a place where indigenous people crossed, over the last century, migrants from Japan, China, Western Europe, many people crossed through here. More in recent decades, people from Central America. And this year, a large population, many thousands of people from Haiti have come through here. So I presented this question of whether the people on the border with Texas came through here to somebody who has access to information to make a very informed guess about it. This is the head, the local head of Mexico's refugee agency. Her name is Alma Delia Cruz Marquez, and here's what she had to say.
Claro, yo creo que sí. Yo creo que sí porque el movimiento de personas haitianas inició.
Cruz Marquez explains that just a few weeks ago, many, many people started missing their interviews for their refugee applications here in Mexico. And a couple of days after that, she saw news reports of thousands of people camped under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas, and across the river in Ciudad Acuña in Mexico. And in addition to that, the migration pattern is that people enter Mexico through the south, and they eventually lead up north. So it really does appear that if not everybody, a large portion of the people who arrived in Del Rio, Texas, they came through right here, the city of Tapachula.
And as you've been speaking with some of the people from Haiti there in this crossroads of Tapachula, Jorge, what are you hearing about where they've been coming from and where they hope to be going?
Yeah, those are two of the questions that I've been asking every single person, and also asking people why they're here and what they're doing here. So one of the first people I spoke to was a woman named Juliana. She is from Haiti. She didn't want to give me her last name because she didn't want to prejudice her refugee application here in Mexico. But she said that she left Haiti 4 years ago for Chile, recently came up to Tapachula just a couple of months ago, and now she's making a living selling water on the street.
Energética, agua, bebida, coca.
Juliana, when I spoke to her, was pushing a dolly with a bucket full of water bottles as well as Coca-Colas, energy drinks, ice. And she says she doesn't make much money. By the way, she's speaking Spanish that she learned in Chile and before that, the Dominican Republic. She says on a good day, like the best of days, she'll make the equivalent of $4. Other days, she doesn't make any money at all.
A mí me cobran 900
pesos.
Juliana says she rents a room for $45 per month, and she says when she left Chile, she wanted to reach the United States, but she's stuck in Mexico because immigration officials make it really difficult for people to travel north. Now, she says she wishes she'd stayed in Chile. Juliana says she walked through the rainforest between Colombia and Panama for 10 days. It's known as the Darien Gap, where many people die from hunger or thirst or run into violent criminals. Virtually all Haitians here in southern Mexico had to cross through there. Juliana says she couldn't get the documentation in Chile to bring her 4 children from Haiti. She was hoping she could do that in the United States.
La primera tiene 13, la mayor.
¿Y los otros?
A 8, 7 y 9.
Juliana says her kids are 13, 9, 8, and 7, and her desire to be with them again is what keeps her going. Foreigners are nothing new here in Tapachula. Manuel Soto, who was born and raised here, sells knickknacks at the Haitian market.
De hecho, Tapachula es una ciudad cosmopolita.
Soto says Tapachula is a cosmopolitan city. He says he's used to seeing people from Central America rolling through. He's just not used to seeing a large population of Haitians staying for months at a time. They now make up the largest nationality requesting refugee status in Mexico. Most are here in Tapachula.
No somos gente racista, porque mucha gente nos tilda de que somos racistas.
Soto says people in Tapachula are not racist, and he brings this up without my even asking about any kind of discrimination. He complains that there's more trash on the street now. He says he wishes the local government would establish more order. In recent weeks, Mexican immigration officials have raided hotels hosting Haitian migrants and have been documented physically assaulting them and referring to them with racial slurs.
Bruno Mentol,
And yet more natives of Haiti continue to arrive in southern Mexico every day. Bruno Mentor is a 25-year-old who says he lived in Chile for 3 years. He got here to Tapachula just last week.
Chile, Bolivia, Colombia, Ecuador, Panama, Costa Rica.
Just like the thousands of Haitians already here, Mentor has traveled through more than a dozen countries. Mentor says his goal was to bring his 4-year-old daughter from Haiti to the United States. But seeing how difficult it's become to cross Mexico, he says he might try to stay and get a job here instead.
That's the world's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, in southern Mexico. We'll be hearing more of his reporting in the coming days on migration from Haiti. You know, when your local donut shop starts serving guacamole spread, it's a sign that avocados have gone totally mainstream. Mexico produces the most avocados, followed by the Dominican Republic, Peru, and Colombia. Good business for those countries, green gold, they call it. But researchers worry about the environmental impacts of the avocado boom. In the U.S., close to 100 million pounds of avocados are sold for Super Bowl Sunday alone. Reporter Megan Janetsky looked at some of the consequences from Sonson, a small avocado-growing town in Colombia.
Baltazar Castaña walks through rows of avocado trees in his farm outside Sonson. He was the first farmer in the region to switch out his crops for avocados 30 years ago. But it was just in the past few years that the global demand for these avocados really began skyrocketing. We look up through one tree where dozens of green avocados hang above our heads. Castaña points to how big the crop is. In the past 5 years, the dense forest and the small-scale farms of the surrounding Andean mountains have been replaced by operations like his. The avocados grown here get shipped all across the world, mostly to the United States and Europe. As we walk, Castaña shakes his head and points high up into the mountain to a patch of scorched earth which someone has burnt down to farm. They call the fruit green gold, and there's a good reason for it. The industry has completely transformed the economies in zones like Sonson, even pulling people out of poverty. The country now exports more than 500,000 tons of Haas avocado, a record up from just 1,400 tons in 2014. This makes Colombia the third largest avocado exporter in the world. On a rainy day, I drive out to another avocado farm nearby. This one belongs to Diego Perez Jimenez, a 19-year-old farmer who recently switched his coffee crop to grow avocados for the U.S. company Westfalia. Perez said it gave him economic stability his family has never had. We have something stable here, he says, an indefinite contract. That means he has health and social security benefits, a pension, steady pay. It's almost unheard of for farmers. You can plan for the future, he says. And if you're sick, you don't have to work that day. Back in town, I catch up with Joaquin Guillermo Ramirez, a researcher at Colombia's Universidad Nacional. He says this rapid expansion has environmental ripple effects. He worked in avocado fields growing up and has spent years investigating the impact of these farms. He says the crop grew quickly outside the correct environmental areas in a disorganized fashion. The way growers have operated has been predatory, he says, and they're now moving into nature reserves. In warmer or colder climates, avocado plants, already heavy water users, require even more resources. In Sonson, local official Cristian Perez says two particular foreign companies, one from Chile and another from Peru, are pushing avocado farms further into the mountains than local growers have gone before. We climb out to a nature reserve and hike up through two key ecosystems that tower over the town. One is a cold weather forest key to mitigating climate change. The other, higher up, is the páramo, high altitude wetlands, and the water source for lands and rivers below, which in turn supply much of Colombia with drinking water. The growers press up against the delicate ecosystems because the climate allows them to sell during the off-season. He says that they get close to the páramo to get cooler conditions, so that it delays the production and they can get better prices on international markets. The environmental impacts of Haas growing on water and forest land have been well documented in other countries, like Mexico and Chile. In Colombia, the crop is still relatively new, but local reporting has documented contaminated local drinking water and deforestation. As he sits near the center of Sonson, Ramirez warns that that environmental impact will only be magnified with climate change. He and the local official predict longer droughts will force avocado growers to pull water from the delicate páramo ecosystem, which will affect the life below. Rising temperatures, meanwhile, may push farms higher into the mountains. Baltazar Castaña, the avocado grower, is also worried. The grower himself has tried to make his farm environmentally friendly, growing endangered Colombian plants important to local bird species near his house. He says there needs to be more regulation and enforcement on the industry. The government needs to be very careful not to let them invade the páramo areas with crops, because that would be grievous, he says. They're going to use up all of our water. After all, he says, it's the only land we've got. For The World, I'm Megan Janetsky, Sonson, Colombia.
The wild birds Baltazar Castaña sees at his home in Sonson may also be a solution to deforestation. That's what some landowners about a five-hour drive away from Baltazar are discovering. Manuel Rueda reports from the Colombian state of Caldas that farmers there are realizing the country's extraordinary diversity is an asset.
It's early in the morning, and tourists are peering over a wooden balcony to take a look at a tiny bird. Hopping among the ferns and leaves on the forest floor is the crescent-faced antpita, a bird the size of a tennis ball with large eyes and a tiny beak. Its round body is covered with black and yellow feathers. Birdwatchers love this species because it's very hard to spot, says Juan Lopez, a nature guide who's traveling with two British tourists.
Before this place exists, the only option to see this antpita was in Ecuador, in Cerro Mangus. You have to walk, hiking 2 days, and camping there trying to see them. But here it's quite reliable. That's the main reason people come here for that antpita.
We're at Hacienda El Bosque, a large dairy farm that's surrounded by cloud forests. The ranch used to get all of its income from selling milk, but it opened its doors to bird watchers 3 years ago in order to generate new sources of income.
That one is the color Inca.
The owners have realized that the Andean cloud forest attracts dozens of migratory birds and is also home to species like the antpita. So instead of clearing the forest to make more space for cattle, they have decided to protect it. Juan Martin Perez is one of the farm's owners.
La razón principal por la que protegimos el bosque y por la que mi papá empezó a proteger el bosque hace 30 años.
30 years ago, my father started to protect some of the forest because he wanted to keep our sources of water safe, Perez says. Now we're using these forests to create a beautiful experience for tourists, especially those interested in birdwatching and photography. While some parts of Colombia face growing rates of deforestation, there are also dozens of farms like El Bosque that have taken a chance on ecotourism. The estate has an area of 1,000 hectares, and almost half is covered by cloud forests. Three cabins have been built for visitors who want to sleep over, as well as observation decks and a trail through the estate's forested area. Perez is hoping that next year, the farm will make 50% of its revenues from tourism. Milk sales have fallen recently, he says, because of international trade deals.
Encontramos que en el turismo naturaleza hay un mercado gigante a nivel internacional.
Around the world, there's a big market for nature tourism, Perez says. For us, it's important to diversify and look for alternatives. He's not the only one thinking along these lines. Within an hour's drive, there are two coffee estates and some smaller farms that also offer birdwatching tours. At El Color de Mis Revs, or The Color of My Dreams, one of the main attractions is the black-billed mountain toucan. When I arrive, a guide hangs some grapes from a branch and lures the toucan with a call that comes from a speaker. Within 20 minutes, the colorful bird arrives, eats a grape, and starts to crackle. The farm is owned by Andres Giraldo, a retired businessman who moved here to be away from the city. It's located next to a nature reserve, and Giraldo is letting the forest regrow all around his property to give more space to the wildlife. The forest cover here is only interrupted by 4 log cabins and 2 yurts, where tourists can spend the night. This isn't a business that turns a profit overnight. It takes some time, Giraldo says. But we're doing this because we are passionate about conservation. We want people to learn about the birds and the forest, and the value it has in our lives. Around 1,900 bird species have been spotted in Colombia so far, more than any other country in the world. So there's plenty to show to tourists, as long as bird habitats are preserved. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Manizales, Colombia.
In Cuba, a jailed artist has been granted a strange sort of freedom. He's been exiled. Visual artist Hamlet Labastida had been held in a maximum security prison in Havana since June on the charge of instigation to commit a crime. This past Saturday, Cuban officials took Labastida from the prison directly to the airport, then put him on a plane headed to Poland with his partner, Cuban writer Catherine Bisquet. Joining me now is another Cuban artist and activist who knows the experience of being detained by the Cuban government. Tania Bruguera is now at Harvard University, where she's a senior lecturer in media and performance. You know Hamlet Labastida personally, Tania. Who is he?
Yeah, Hamlet Labastida was my student 20 years ago. He is an artist who is interested in the history of Cuba and the history of totalitarian regime. Someone who has studied for the last 15 years the transition process in East Europe. And that's what he works in his collages and his illustrations and animations and installations. He has studied the history of repression in Cuba like nobody else.
Can you give us an example of his recent work?
His work has the form of stencils. He takes images of the propaganda logos used in different institutions in Cuba, official institutions, and he makes a stencil out of the compositions. And the beauty of it is that the stencils should be used to spray paint on walls and on the street. But because it is forbidden in Cuba, what he does is just showing the stencil, like almost the possibility of maybe one day being able to stamp your ideas in the public sphere.
So Hamlet Labastida was released from maximum security prison in Cuba and sent to Poland. Why Poland as opposed to another country?
Family reasons. His kid, whose mother is Polish, and the kid himself was born in Poland. So that was the visa that could be granted to him.
Can we assume that Hamlet Labastida was given a choice, continued prison or exile?
He was actually put in that position where he had to choose between remaining in jail indeterminately or leaving the country. So he was obliged to exile.
So the charge that Labastida faced back in June when he was arrested, instigation to commit a crime, help us understand what that's about.
Well, Cuba has a legal system that, first of all, is selective. So the law do not apply to everyone. For example, if you are close to the government or people in power, you can literally steal, be corrupt, and you will not be sentenced or trial in the same way the rest of the Cubans. And if you are a dissident or if you have shown any animosity towards the government, is judged in a very, very harsh way. For example, if you are in the street with a protest poster, instead of judging you for demonstrating in the street, they will judge you for disrupting peace in the public space.
So did the charge relate to any of Labastida's works of art?
Absolutely not. They are related to the fact that he is a member of the 27N movement.
Which is what?
It is a movement that was created last year on the 27th of November when more than 500 artists from all disciplines demonstrated in front of the Ministry of Culture and demanding the institution to intervene in favor of artists with the government and to defend the right artists have.
So those artist demonstrations, as you said, were last November. Then this past July, dramatic demonstrations against the Cuban government by citizens of all stripes. Did you take part in those?
I was going to participate. We had a plan with a group of other artists to go in front of the National TV building to demand 5 minutes of air to explain who we are, why we wanted to do this. I could not join them because I had police in front of my building waiting for me to go out. So a lot of the activists begged me not to go out because they wanted me to do some other work than to be beaten by this group of people.
What has become of that protest movement, Tanya?
We still have around 800 people in prison. It's not legal because the people who went out on the 11th of July had the constitutional right under Article 56 to peacefully demonstrate in the streets. The problem is that the Cuban government is afraid of a new demonstration, which everyone is expecting. We don't know when or how, but everybody is expecting that. And they think that by having that many people in jail, they will stop something that is unavoidable.
Hmm. So jailing any dissident shuts them up. Jailing an artist dissident also shuts down their platform. Does being exiled or Hamlet La Vestida, does it effectively accomplish that because their work can't get back to the island?
Yes and no. If you are outside, sometimes you have a better condition to tell your story. But what the government do is once you leave the country, they use that to discredit you. It almost feels like the only legitimate position is to be physically inside the island. And of course, if you are a dissident physically inside the island, your life will be reduced to nothing or be in jail until they decide it's not useful anymore for them.
So what does this all mean for you? Will you be able to return to Cuba?
We don't know. This is the power they have. This is the magic of Cuba. The government can do whatever they want.
Tanya Bruguera is a Cuban artist and activist and a senior lecturer in media and performance at Harvard University. Tanya, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I got 1, 2, 3, 4. This is Radio P.
This is Radio Peace, a quirky little riff. We're told it is a previously unpublished song by John Lennon and Yoko Ono. The crackly recording is from a cassette tape just auctioned off in Denmark for nearly $60,000. Here's Alexa Brun Rasmussen, the director of branding at the Auction House in Copenhagen.
To have John Lennon up for auction for us here in Copenhagen is extremely unique.
The 33-minute tape also features an interview with Lennon and Ono conducted by four Danish teenagers in 1970. The kids got permission to skip school to interview perhaps the world's most famous couple for their school newspaper. On the recording, Lennon speaks about performing with the Beatles, who at the time were only a few months from officially breaking up. Lennon also speaks about a passion he became known for, bringing peace to the world. One of the Danish teens asks him about his campaign. The audio here provided by broadcaster France 24.
But how do you think that people like me can help you with making the peace of all the world?
You all, if you can't think of any idea yourself, imitate what we do. But just try and just sit down and think, what can I do locally?
Think local. John Lennon yet again demonstrating that he was ahead of his time. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. Think local, and we'll see you tomorrow. From PRX.